Issues that are kind of preliminary issues here, preemption in the traditional sense and foreign policy preemption. I think just as a little bit of background, obviously the discussion in the first panel indicates that the federal government response to climate change is at best characterized as unsettled, certainly not a legislative response in the way we have with many of our other environmental issues in the country. In the face of increasingly clear and what is sometimes described as potentially catastrophic threats to public health and in the environment, I think it was inevitable that states and local governments and NGOs would step in to fill the policy void, increasingly raising issues of expressed or implied preemption or foreign policy preclusion. States, of course, have often been in a position where they are filling voids in federal legislation. Perhaps one of the best examples of that occurred almost a little more than 20 years ago. For the entire decade of the 1980s, Congress was deadlocked on how to deal with acid rain. State attorneys general from New England and the Midwest, many of the same attorneys general who are involved in the Connecticut case, and the Massachusetts case, sued EPA to get tighter SO2 standards. These states' efforts ended only when Congress passed the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments that put in place the acid rain cap and trade program. In a sense, a very similar situation to greenhouse gases, although I think greenhouse gas issues are bigger in scale, likely to be more serious, certainly more costly to resolve, and the inaction at the federal level is a little more complex. There haven't, other than a few areas not directly in the environmental, what we consider core environmental areas, there hasn't been major federal legislation passed in 17 years. And there's no indication, at least currently, that there's likely to be movement on federal legislation. Debate in Congress, but clearly no indication that that debate is coming to a conclusion. These circumstances invite, perhaps even compel, states to jump in, and jump in they have. A majority of states now have some form of climate-related legislation, ranging from establishing greenhouse gas reduction targets to regional trading systems, to renewable energy portfolios, to biofuels requirements. And as we've been discussing, states are suing both EPA and emitters. These actions are increasingly raising preemption issues in the context of dual sovereignty. Preemption is an evolving doctrine, and as the National Association of Attorneys General noted in a recent white paper on preemption, there is no clear and unified theory of preemption in the federal courts. There are a lot of theories: express preemption, implied preemption, field preemption, conflict preemption, obstacle preemption, and increasingly the issue of foreign policy preemption that has come to the fore since climate issues are the subject of extensive international debate. Judge Sessions held that Vermont's automobile standard did not represent a, quote, insufferable intrusion into the field of foreign policy, but the issue is really just beginning as the states play an increasingly active role on international issues. Just this week, 14 states, 8 European countries, New Zealand and Norway signed an agreement to participate in something called the International Carbon Action Partnership. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in New England is looking at involving several Canadian provinces in that initiative. So increasingly, the states are also engaging in what might look like foreign policy efforts on the climate change issue. We have an excellent panel here to discuss the preemption issues, and I'll now introduce them briefly, and we can proceed. On my immediate left, Kevin Lasky. Kevin has been an assistant attorney general in the Environmental Division of the Vermont Attorney General's Office since 2002. For the past 2 years, he has focused almost exclusively on air pollution and global warming cases, including the Green Mountain case. Then we have Charles Hake, who's an associate in the Washington, D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. Mr. Hake has represented clients in actions concerning greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, and among the cases he's been involved in is the Green Mountain case. And then we have Doug Kendall, who is with Community Rights Council, the founder of that organization and its executive director. Doug has represented local government clients in state and federal appellate courts around the country and before the Supreme Court. And like our previous panel, we have University of Virginia graduates, two of them here, and one one Vermont Law School graduate. So I'm not sure which order you want to go in, but we can, if there's not a preference, we'll start with Kevin.
Sure. Well, we talked about how to present this, and we thought it would be helpful to introduce the Green Mountain case first, and then get to the various preemption issues as it relates both to in this context as well as to broader to other maybe U.S. Supreme Court cases that are out there. It's first important to recognize that the issue in the Green Mountain case really is a Clean Air Act issue. In other words, the Clean Air Act calls for two types of automobile standards, and those are EPA standards and standards developed by California. And this dates back to really the beginning of the Clean Air Act in the 1970, when Congress was making this determination about, okay, we're going to regulate new motor vehicle emissions on the federal level. Should all the states be able to continue to regulate, or should it just be the exclusive control of the federal government? It's important to note that California was actually the only state who at the time had already begun to regulate motor vehicle emissions. And so essentially, like what happens in a lot of debates down on the Hill, there was a compromise where California was allowed to continue to regulate with EPA oversight, and EPA would also then have new motor vehicle emission standards. And at the same time, there was the Energy Policy and Conservation Act, which Charlie will talk about in a little bit, that was also being negotiated and enacted during the 70s. California in about 4 or 5 years ago began to develop these greenhouse gas emission regulations for new motor vehicles using what they said was their existing authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate new motor vehicles subject to EPA approval. Under Section 177 of the Clean Air Act, other states are allowed to basically follow California's lead, provided that they adopt regulations that are identical to California's, and there's a couple other conditions that are present as well. And so Vermont, continuing what we had been doing since the mid-90s, essentially adopted standards identical to California's. And again, these regulate have a declining fleet average. Don't want to go to all the details of the regulations, but basically starting in model year 2009 all the way up to 2016. California, once they had adopted their regulations, faced a lawsuit from the auto industry. There was two groups, an international association and sort of a domestic association, as well as Daimler, Chrysler, and General Motors, and some other local dealers. So the litigation started out there well before the Vermont litigation. Once we had finished our regulatory rulemaking in November of 2005, we faced essentially a similar suit. So it was an interesting situation where you had essentially identical lawsuits being litigated in California and then in Vermont, and then there was then subsequently another federal suit filed in Rhode Island. And essentially, I think the it's the auto industry was challenging that the regulations out in California, which is the Ninth Circuit, chose the Vermont for the Second Circuit, which also Second Circuit is New York, Connecticut, and Vermont. And Rhode Island was the kind of the First Circuit case representing Maine, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. The litigation was basically went on in tandem for the last about year or so, with the California case leading slightly ahead of the Vermont case, both scheduled to go to trial earlier this year. And indeed, we did have a trial in Vermont, a 16-day federal bench trial. Unfortunately, it was, well, from our point of view, is that it went before California's trial, which was basically the lead case. The judge out there had stayed the case pending the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. And when we went to our judge, Judge Sessions said, for similar reasons, we've been following behind the California case. Let's continue to follow the California case and allow the trial to go on out there first and then litigate here. Judge Sessions denied our motion, and we proceeded to trial here. The central claims in the case, there were, in the beginning, there were a number of them, ranging from, as mentioned, the foreign policy preemption. There was also a dormant commerce clause, a statutory cause of action under the Clean Air Act, another Clean Air Act preemption clause. But the principal claim that, besides the foreign policy claim, was the claim that the Vermont and California's regulations were essentially fuel economy standards. These weren't emission standards. They were actually fuel economy standards that were preempted under a separate federal statute that gave authority to the Department of Transportation.
Great. Thanks. Very good summary, Kevin. First, I'd like to start off, I guess, with the same disclaimer that Joe gave you last time, that I'm here speaking on my own behalf with my own views, and not necessarily on behalf of my firm's clients.
I should as well for this. Exactly.
But, you know, as we're all lawyers, I'm sure we understand that legal disclaimers are important. I guess I was not surprised that the very first sentence out of Kevin's mouth I disagreed with. In our view, this case is not about the Clean Air Act, but rather about the Energy Policy and Conservation Act. That is the act that sets fuel economy standards by the federal government. You've heard of, it's called CAFE, Corporate Average Fuel Economy. And those are the standards whereby certain cars, you know, cars get certain miles per gallon of fuel economy. EPCA contains a very broad preemption provision. It's one of those, quote, related to preemption provisions. And it provides that no state or political subdivision thereof may enact or enforce a regulation relating to fuel economy standards. Now, if you were to go ask any automotive engineer out there, if you think of carbon dioxide emissions, what do you think of? First thing off your mind, he's going to say fuel economy. That is because when it comes to any carbon-based fuel, carbon dioxide emissions are fuel economy. There's, unlike other pollutants, for example, oxides of nitrogen, hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, there's nothing you can do with the carbon dioxide that's coming out of a car and reduce it, capture it, anything else. If you're going to burn a certain gallon of fuel, you're going to emit a certain amount of carbon dioxide. There's nothing you can do about it. So it was our contention all along that these regulations are related to fuel economy standards. And at the beginning of the case, we thought we were in very, very strong grounds because we had a groundswell of opinion that was in our favor. This particular regulations were actually the second time the state of California attempted to regulate carbon dioxide emissions from motor vehicles. California's got they have a long-standing motor vehicle program that they had in place since the 1960s. And back in the early 1990s, they enacted what's called the ZEV program, Zero Emission Vehicle. And the purpose of that program was so that the state would have a certain percentage of the vehicles on the road be zero emissions. The idea was to have battery-powered vehicles. The problem was they thought it would only cost a couple thousand dollars to produce battery-powered vehicles, but it actually cost much, much more, and it was clear that the manufacturers were not going to be able to comply with that. So what they did was they amended it, and they said, well, we'll give you credits if you produce certain kinds of vehicles that are really, really good. And those kinds of vehicles are ones that have lower emissions of carbon dioxide and get better fuel economy. Those regulations were challenged back in 2002, and an injunction was granted in favor against the regulations, basically holding that they were preempted by EPCA. That case kind of settled, even though it was appealed, it settled out, and so nothing really happened on appeal to see what would happen with that particular decision. Since that time, two federal agencies looked at the same question. Is the regulation of fuel economy the same thing as regulation of carbon dioxide emissions? And they both said yes. The first federal agency, I think, in time was EPA. And this kind of takes us to the mass versus EPA angle. As you heard from the last panel, certain states sued EPA, telling EPA that they needed to enact regulations for carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. One of the laundry lists of reasons for EPA to not do so was they said that carbon dioxide emissions are tantamount to fuel economy, and if we were to regulate it, that might have an impact on what our sister agency is doing with regard to fuel economy standards. As we all know, that decision was overturned in Mass versus EPA, but on slightly different grounds. The other agency that addressed the question is the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. That is the federal agency that runs the federal CAFE program. They're the ones who set the limits. And in some recent rules where they enacted more stringent standards for light trucks, then a lengthy discussion in the preamble talking about regulations such as these, where they lay out the technical bases for why a carbon dioxide emissions regulation is the same thing as a fuel economy regulation. And they've determined that based on their reading of their own statute, they've determined such regulations are preempted. So with all that, we thought we were on very strong grounds going to court. Well, you know, I guess things are never as they seem in litigation, and anything can happen, and Judge Sessions disagreed. The main reason, if you'd read his opinion, why he disagreed is that he viewed the interplay between the Clean Air Act and EPCA as evincing some sort of, if you ask me, metaphysical congressional intent that regulations like these were not meant by Congress to be preempted. In our view, he ignored the plain language of both the statutes and was incorrect, and therefore we're dealing with those issues on appeal right now. So I tried to stay away from giving some more of the technical aspects of either the regulation or how cars work, but I'm happy to do so if you'd like on question and answer.
Because we're not involved, Community Rights Council, the organization I run, is not involved in either the Green Mountain or the California case. I'll try to put a bigger perspective on this and not go into the details either, which we can come back to. First question, and this gets a little bit to how Lee started us, is why does state innovation here matter so much? Why is it so important? Why are we fighting over what California is trying to do in regulating greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles? Why does this fight matter so much? Well, first is, if you look at the history of environmental law, the history is that states have started first. They've put together something of a patchwork of regulations at the state level. That changes the debate at the federal level because industry now sees, wait, we got to deal with this regulation from California, this regulation from Massachusetts, this regulation from Michigan. Why don't we get all together and see if we can make something make sense here? And so state regulation brings people to the table. And if you see what's happening, you know, the gridlock that we've experienced on the federal level for global warming, you see why that matters so much. And it's gridlock not just with the Bush administration and Republican Congress. It's gridlock with the Clinton administration before it. It could be gridlock if it's the Clinton administration after it. Even if there's a Democratic Senate and Congress, you still have people like John Dingell who are trying to protect the auto industry. You still have a lot of things that can slow down, block the establishment of meaningful federal law on this. And the one thing that could really push it along is states going out there, starting to solve these problems, starting to make industry reduce their emissions, and to start to bring industry to the table. So state innovation does two things. One, it starts solving the problems. It gives examples of how you can get at the problem of reducing emissions. And two, it fundamentally alters the debate at the federal level by bringing industry, which otherwise doesn't want to be part of the discussion, into the discussion. And so you see, and I thought John's comment from the earlier panel where he said, oh, we just want to be part of the discussion. Well, they don't want to be part of the discussion until there's a meaningful discussion, until they're starting to get gored at the state level. And the second thing he said was, we don't want lawsuits. Well, all the cases we're talking about are industry challenging state and local innovation here. They want lawsuits, just their kind of lawsuits. So that's what innovation here, that's why this matters so much. And what industry is trying to do right now is head off that very state innovation. They're trying to say, no, wait a second, you states, you can't innovate and you can't do this, and so we're going to cut off the discussion in the court and with lawsuits. Now, that gets to the legal issue that we're talking about here today, which is preemption. Preemption is one of those really undiscovered, unappreciated hot topics in Supreme Court litigation. According to a recent study, between 1986 and 2004, 104 of the 1,302 civil cases before the Supreme Court, full 8% of the Supreme Court civil docket was preemption cases. That's a huge number, bigger than anything else. And these cases are enormously important to kind of ordinary Americans. So you have in the Waters versus Wachovia case that came out last term, you have the Supreme Court striking down state predatory lending statutes that protect consumers in all 50 states. You have in a case that's going up to the Supreme Court this term, or being heard by the Supreme Court this term, a case called Regal versus Medtronic. You have a question of whether state common law in all 50 states is preempted any time the Federal Drug Administration reviews a submission by a drug company about a product. So whether that review by the Federal Drug Administration prevents the common law in 50 states from holding manufacturers accountable for their defective products. These are enormously important, and yet they get virtually no coverage by the Supreme Court press corps, which, you know, there's one or two civil rights or abortion cases a term. Those get all the headlines. These cases, numerous every term, that affect the pockets and lives of Americans all across the country get no coverage whatsoever. Now, part of the reason they don't get the coverage is they don't divide the Supreme Court along kind of ordered or structured ideological lines. So in the Waters versus Wachovia case, and I mentioned last term, the vote was 5-3, and the dissent saying no preemption, that these predatory lending statutes should go forward, was written by Justice Stevens, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, along with Justice Scalia. So all across the court's ideological poles were in the dissent. And on the other hand, the mass middle of the court all said this was preempted. It's not at all atypical in preemption cases. The same split or similar split was the case in both the two most important preemption cases over the last decade, the Greyer versus American Honda case with a 5-4 case, completely atypical split, the Garamendi case, which if we get into foreign policy preemption, the exact same thing. Now, while the court is usually split on these cases, it has been overwhelmingly ruling in favor of preemption, meaning in the vast majority of these cases it has found preemption. Let me give you one example, and it's relevant to the fact pattern we have here. The Supreme Court, about 3 years ago, in a case that we were involved, Community Rights Council was involved in, called Engine Manufacturers Association versus South Coast Air Quality Management District, it dealt with a somewhat related issue of preemption under the Clean Air Act, and it involves the South Coast, which is South Coast Air Quality Management District, which covers Southern California, the most polluted air region in our country, tried to put in place rules that prevented or that regulated the cars and other vehicles that big fleets in the area could buy. Now, the Clean Air Act preempts state and local governments from implementing standards relating to automobile emissions. And our argument was, these are about purchasing. These are about what cars you can buy. This isn't about what vehicles have to be produced at all. In that case, that was rejected 8-1 by the Supreme Court. And there's, you know, Charlie mentioned the relating to language. It's kind of, it can be, and has been in certain Supreme Court cases, akin to the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon test. I mean, everything is related to everything else once, you know, if you look at that term as broadly as you possibly can. And so, one of the, getting back to, and I'll just end with a little bit about the cases that we're dealing with today, the Vermont and the California case involving the California global warming emission rules. If you see the two positions here, the plaintiffs are saying this is a preemption case under the CAFE rule. The defendants are saying, wait a second, this isn't a preemption case at all. This is a Clean Air Act case. And what, you know, what that argument and Kevin basically said is basically once the EPA approves, grants a waiver for California rules, it becomes part of the federal program. And so, and that federal program, those federal rules are have to be assumed or considered when the NHTSA, the National Transportation,
National Highway Traffic Safety
Administration, creates CAFE rules. And so they're saying, look, this is just a battle between two federal laws, and you have to reconcile these two federal laws, where industry is saying, no, wait, this is a state law, it's preempted by this federal law. And they're doing so because, one of the reasons they're doing so is the Supreme Court has been pretty sympathetic to preemption claims over the last couple decades.
We'll open it up to questions in just a moment, but I wanted to follow up with Doug, because the two cases that you mentioned, Wachovia and Medtronic, are interesting developments in and of themselves, in that the preemption comes through administrative agency rules, as I understand it, in both of those cases. At least one of them is an administrative agency rule. It's probably based on statutory preemption language, but the National Association of Attorneys General noted that this is kind of an increasing development where not Congress, but administrative agencies pass rules based on some statutory language that then become preemptive of the states or local governments, and that trend itself may be of some concern. I don't know whether you have any thoughts about that.
Well, it is certainly true that, I mean, there's been a very interesting development about regarding federalism in this country over the last 20 or 25 years. If you look back at the Reagan administration and even the folks driving the contract with America, the Gingriches of the world, they were very, very aggressive at promoting the role of states and endorsing federalism and siding against preemption. That has come 180 degrees with the Bush administration, which has been incredibly aggressive about issuing rules that say, we're going to preempt what state and local governments are doing, and the Solicitor General's office, the Justice Department office that takes positions for the federal government, has been incredibly aggressive about reversing prior positions about whether federal action or federal regulations or anything federal preempts state and local. The conservative idea that we should preserve areas of state and local autonomy has just completely gone out the window with this administration. And so now you have, typically it's been environmentalists, been people on the liberal side of the spectrum who have been advocating for state and local innovation. That's a dramatic change in politics in this country.
And I wanted to ask one other question of Charles and Kevin, and that is kind of the core of Judge Sessions' decision in his case, which, is, as Doug mentioned, seems to be the characterization of what was going on. Judge Sessions characterized the dispute as being one of reconciling conflicting federal provisions, and therefore the focus was reconciliation. And he found that there were lots of instances where EPA and NHTSA had to reconcile their positions, and whereas the argument was clearly, you don't get to that. This is preempted. This is not an issue of reconciling federal language. So I'd like the comments for both on that issue.
Well, I'll start real quick. It's interesting you put it that way, because you've got two statutes involved, the Clean Air Act, which is administered by EPA, mm-hmm. and you've got EPCA, which is administered by NHTSA. Both of those agencies came out on record as saying, we view carbon dioxide emissions being tantamount to fuel economy, and therefore falling under the NHTSA realm, not the Clean Act realm. So to the extent there's really reconciling going on, I would think, as a judge, I'd want to know what the administrative agencies think, because they work with these statutes all the time. But apparently that's not that important to Judge Sessions. I do agree that he was kind of viewing it as, I've got these kind of two statutes in front of me, and, how am I going to look at it? And we kind of, I think he kind of viewed it kind of as a gestaltish view to say, well, based on what I'm seeing here, I just don't think Congress intended that this kind of regulation would be preempted. And we thought that he should kind of go a little bit more deeper and actually look at the language of the statutes and see what they said and kind of parse through the language, which we don't think he did.
Well, I mean, first, as a factual matter, he did nonetheless engage in a thorough analysis of both the express preemption and the implied preemption analysis. In other words, Judge Sessions did at first, his primary ruling was that, we don't really need a traditional preemption analysis because this is this reconciliation of two federal statutes. But it's important to recognize too that the Massachusetts versus EPA decision came down in the middle of this case, and that really changed the landscape, as it were, as Judge Sessions recognized, because in there, Massachusetts versus EPA has to do with whether EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. And one of the arguments, as Charlie mentioned, was that EPA said, well, look, NHTSA says it's hands off, and, we agree. And the Supreme Court explicitly rejected that proposition and said that, look, even though there is this overlap between fuel economy and regulating carbon dioxide, there's really no conflict. The goals of the federal statute of the Clean Air Act is to protect public health. EPCA is to promote energy efficiency, and basically said this is okay, and expected that there maybe would be this federal coordination, and that was one thing Judge Sessions recognized. The other point, though, that the EPCA and Clean Air Act kind of provisions at issue aren't just completely segregated. In other words, there's a separate provision in EPCA that classifies and requires NHTSA, when it sets these fuel economy standards, to take into account other federal government standards. And one of the federal government or standards of the government that Congress expressly had NHTSA consider was Clean Air Act standards, specifically EPA and sort of the California standards under Section 209. So it's not that it was just that he was reconciling these two statutes and just saying I'm choosing the Clean Air Act. He recognized that even within EPCA there was this sort of textual commitment for NHTSA to take into account the Clean Air Act standards when performing its regulatory role.
I think with that, we'll open it up to questions from the audience. Jim.
Thank you. In light of the recent period of climate change cases, and I guess I'm wondering is whether innovation in climate change is in the constitutional law. We start off looking at Congress and states and courts and individual rights. We see 20 reasons it isn't, right? For Congress, what I've heard is that there are commerce clause questions about whether regulating climate change is inherently economic in nature. Congress doesn't have the authority. That litigation is to come. Also, under the necessary and proper clause, that Congress can't even regulate climate change, even if it has authority under Article 1, Section 8. If it doesn't have it there, then maybe the general welfare clause, but not only is that, that it addresses taxing and spending, and it can't coerce what it can't demand. And then as EPA figured out, we have non-delegation issues, and that's just on the congressional side. The state side, because eventually we have preemption, we have dormant commerce clause, we have treaty clauses, we have takings. In the judiciary, we have standing, a political question. And just the way the people side, individually, we have issues of again, preemption, 11th Amendment, can't sue states. 9th Amendment is falling suit to due process, there's no substantive due process on the right to any of this. But procedural due process, liberty interest. And lastly, some people are beginning to think about, you know, we've been so desperate enough now that we're thinking about the protection clause. So, what do you think? Do you think that we'll ever get to a point where we'll all agree that regulating or innovation in climate change is
I'm going to repeat the question. But the question is it constitutional? Is it constitutional to regulate for climate change purposes? We'll leave it at that.
I don't know if there's any dispute on the panel that the federal government would have Commerce Clause authority to regulate for Commerce Clause for global warming nationally. If there is, I'm happy to debate it, but I'd be surprised if anyone seriously would maintain an argument that the federal government can't use its Commerce Clause authority to combat global warming. I don't think that would get one vote at the Supreme Court, perhaps Justice Thomas, certainly not Justice Scalia, and so at best one vote. I just don't think it's a serious argument. The preemption questions are all derivative. Yes, states can certainly regulate to combat global warming under their inherent police power authority. The only question is whether some federal law conflicts with it. Now, the Supreme Court has been too aggressive, in my opinion, about finding preemption under federal laws, and may be too aggressive here. But the underlying authority to regulate global warming at the state and local level is unimpeachable, subject only to specific individual constitutional rights and due process takings, none of which I find particularly compelling or serious, although I'm sure there would be claims filed once a federal or meaningful state law is passed. I don't think that there's any serious question about the authority of governments to regulate this. It's just sorting out which level it's going to be at and how to go forward.
I agree with that. I think the missile's already left the silo when it comes to the issue of whether or not there is authority in the federal government to regulate here. I think the issue properly is which level is best suited to do so, and which level has the authority as given by Congress. My position would be that it's best suited to have it decided at the federal level to have national standards, especially when it comes to motor vehicles. It works better, you get better results, it's easier on the manufacturers when it comes to compliance issues, et cetera. And with regard to the state authority, I think you got to kind of look at the differences. When it comes to emissions issues in the Clean Air Act, there's kind of a difference between what they call stationary sources and mobile sources. Under the Clean Air Act, it's pretty clear that states have a very, very large role when it comes to regulating stationary sources. And it makes sense because they're usually located in one state. They don't go anywhere. For mobile sources, Congress said that except for the California exception, we really want the regulation of motor vehicles to be at the federal level. And there's many reasons for that when it comes to economies of production and things like that. And so it would be my position that to the extent that there are regulations of GHG emissions from cars, it should come at the federal level.
I wanted to ask another question that relates to an issue that we haven't talked much about, and that's the foreign policy issue. Judge Sessions said that what was going on in that case wasn't entangling the states too much in foreign policy issues, but it's also clear from some of the recent cases that the courts want to see the United States government vis-a-vis other governments speak with one voice. So as states get more involved in working with other governments, potentially doing greenhouse gas initiatives across borders, is there something to the foreign policy preclusion issue here that should get more attention of the courts and should limit what states are able to do?
I think there is. It is a different analysis when you're talking about states that are engaging in conversations with other foreign governments. As for the for Judge Sessions and his determination, he again looked at Massachusetts versus EPA and recognized that, as the Supreme Court did, that the State Department was the voice of the government with respect to determining the foreign policy of the U.S. With respect to climate change, and we had presented very recent evidence of both State Department papers as well as their position in the international community, which specifically, where the State Department specifically applauded state efforts and in fact cited California as the laboratory of invention and noted how other states were adopting these regulations, and basically then took a look and said, well, look, there's really nothing that the State Department, when you're or anything against the foreign policy for these type of regulations, and that in fact the U.S. is using that as a as to show the world how much the U.S. is doing. So, but there is definitely certainly a different question when you have maybe states acting by virtue of strictly their police power or their independent authority when they start dealing with other nations.
Yeah, the problem with foreign policy preemption is much fuzzier around the edges. You know, in EPCA, you have a clear statement saying we intend to preempt state laws in this particular field. And we can debate kind of where how broad that field is, but you have a clear statement there. When it comes to foreign policy preemption, it's much more difficult to ascertain what is the foreign policy of the United States. You know, what kind of action would be inconsistent with that? You know, very well may be that if this case had come down back in 1997, when the Byrd-Hagel resolution voted 95-0 to reject an approach like the Kyoto Protocol, which would be unilateral in the United States and not require reduction from other countries, maybe it would have been a little clearer question. But things have changed so much between now and then as regards to what the foreign policy is on this issue.
We were up in court in Burlington in front of Judge Sessions when he asked basically that same question. He said, well, what about this foreign policy claim? Are you going to be bringing in witnesses to try to establish the foreign policy of the U.S.? I mean, is Condoleezza Rice coming down, you know, or coming up? You know, and again, we just submitted everything as to documents that they submitted their statements. We did ours, and Judge Sessions ruled basically on that. But it was interesting.
Yeah, Kanye, she didn't respond to our subpoena.
Well, no, just if you look at the cases, you know, the leading or most recent case on foreign policy preemption is the Garamendi case. And in that case, it involved, as I recall, claims by the families of Holocaust victims against foreign banks for deposits that had been kind of lost over time. And in that case, the U.S. government actually had kind of negotiated under memorandums of understanding between the federal government and those countries about these types of claims, and then the state insurance commissioner of California is coming in and trying to kind of set up a different regime or use state tort law to set up a different regime. There you have a very clear established foreign policy position which conflicts with what the state was trying to do, and I think that's at least a classic case of foreign policy preemption, and we just don't have that here.
Arnold.
The Bush administration screwed themselves on this because roughly page 220 of the Sessions of 50. He recognized that the Bush administration said that our foreign policy is going to be based on an annual reduction in greenhouse gases as a function of gross national product, which will be handled by voluntary action and state and local action. And Sessions opposed that as being U.S. foreign policy.
On the greenhouse gas intensity using,
Let me restate that just so that the record gets it. Part of the Judge Sessions' response on foreign policy preemption was that the Bush administration itself had announced an annual percentage reduction using voluntary and state efforts, and therefore seemed to open the door to say there's this is consistent with what's being done in the Vermont case is consistent with a U.S. foreign policy. Any thoughts on that?
Well, the other point that we've made was that the foreign policy of the U.S. was not to seek mandatory reductions, and that everything it had done so far was just voluntary. In other words, it was just two countries engaging in mutually beneficial reductions, but that really wasn't mandatory. And so how can there be this conflict when the U.S. itself isn't looking for mandatory reductions from other countries?
Other questions? All right. We're coming right up on the time to close this session. I want to thank the panelists and thank ELI and our sponsors for the event today.